The Coach Rob Podcast, answering questions and eliminating frustrations about health, wellness, and performance since 1987.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to the Coach Rob Podcast. I'm very excited for this month's guest here on the Coach Rob Podcast, Meet the Guest. I've got a multi-time Olympian, Mr. Connor Fields. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, doing well. Thanks for having me.
I know you're extremely busy. We're going to get a little bit into what's keeping you busy these days, doing a lot of jet setting, doing a lot of TV time, and I'm excited to share with everybody what you're doing now in the next phase of racing. Where are you at today? Where are we talking at?
I'm in my house. I'm sitting here in Las Vegas, Nevada.
All right. So you finally got back home, got out of your suitcases for a while?
Yeah, they don't ever get too comfortable on the shelf, so they're always ready to be grabbed.
It goes without saying, I've had the privilege of working with you at multiple different levels and at different times over the last, 5 to 10 years here. And I'm always amazed whenever we chat, even like this podcast here, we had to push it back a little bit just because you were traveling so much. Where did your last trip take you to?
Oh, that's always a tough question. I feel like it's one of those things where like sometimes you sit at baggage claim, but you're looking up at the monitor, you're like, where am I again? Where am I coming from? that's how it goes. But no, I think most recently I was at a wedding. So it was a trip for fun. It was a personal trip. But before that, lots of stuff in the BMX racing world, as well as filming for my TV show. I work for PBS. We'll get more into that in a little bit, but yep. Doing all sorts of travel for that.
No, I love it. Well, speaking of travel, and I always say this at the beginning of the show, is I try to give a little bit of background on our guest. I always have to take my eyes off the camera because I have so much to read. And when I go through, just to give the listeners a little bit of background with Connor, I want you to realize that, like, if I were to go through all of the achievements from when amateur racing and became like serious racer all the way up, we'd sit here for the first 30 minutes of the hour show and go through accolades. And I know you don't like to hear me say that, but what I'm about to go through is a very abbreviated, but you're going to see how heavy this resume looks. First and foremost, what I think is pretty impressive is Connor turned pro. Golly, what year was that? Was that 2011, wasn't it?
I mean, we could get into that a little bit if you
want. Okay.
The rules were a little different back then. There was it was right as the BMX racing was coming into the Olympics. So there was a number of different governing bodies that you were under, whether it was at the time ABA, the American Bicycle Association, and then the UCI, which was coming in because now it was going to be an Olympic discipline. So
gotcha.
I turned pro with the UCI in 2009, but I was still racing amateur in ABA, American Bicycle Association, which is now USA BMX. I turned pro with them in 2011.
Okay.
So 2009 was my first pro race. It was a week after my 17th birthday. I was a senior in high school. It was a World Cup, and I literally left school on Wednesday, went to the World Cup. I podiumed, snuck into the bar, afterwards, and on Monday morning, I was back at school. So that was the first one.
I absolutely love it. Well, and as you guys just heard, at 17 years old, right? Think about what we were doing at 17 years old. Not many people were on the world stage, and we'll get into what that really means here. Even if you don't come from a BMX background, we'll shed a little bit of light on that. What I do think is really cool, and we're going to go through a little bit more in the results, the entire 9 years of Connor being a pro, he raced for Chase Bicycles, which also has an affiliation and a relationship with Fly. If I'm not mistaken, the Monster deal, that was your own, right, for your entire pro career?
Yep. So Chase Bicycles became a brand in 2011.
Okay.
And I signed on with them like simultaneous to signing my pro paperwork. It was kind of at the same time. And then I raced every lap of my pro career from 2011 through 2021, with Chase. And then I signed a lifetime brand ambassador deal afterwards, which is cool. And then I signed on with Monster in 2012. So right around the same time when I turned pro.
I love it. And for some of you who may not be familiar with these types of ambassador deals, the things that Connor just articulated is not typical. You very rarely hear somebody that wants to do a lifetime brand ambassador deal. And again, as we get through the next hour, you're going to get a better chance to see Connor's integrity, his personality, and you're going to see why these opportunities are here. And Connor, again, I want to say thank you for being on the show, because we do have some parents of some young athletes, you know, and they're trying to figure out how to navigate to get from where they're at to where you got to. And then we have people who've been through a lot of trials and tribulations, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of yours. Something that I want to continue down this path, what a lot of people may or may not realize, and I'm going to go a little bit deeper than maybe Connor's going to be comfortable with, but I want to give just a little bit of breadth of what this guy has been able to do. I refer to him as a legend. He doesn't like me calling him that, but I call him an every time.
I don't need to be a legend yet. Well, in my 40s to be a legend.
Well, that's okay. I'm 56, so you're always going to be that young guy to me. But what you've accomplished at such a young age is so impressive. Back in 2011, this guy raced the Pan American Games. He went 1-6-1 for third overall, and I've got some questions for him. If you know anything about racing, but one, you know, coming back,
what are you referring to? The Pan American Games at Guadalajara?
Yes, sir.
So what you're looking at there is the qualifying motos, not the final.
What did you do in the final there?
I won.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah. So 1-6-1 for third in the, so the top four would have moved out of the motos.
Okay.
Now sixth, I lost the chain and crashed, is what happened on that one. So then I had to like win or get second in the third round to move on to the final.
Yes.
And I was bloody. I have the jersey on the wall and it's all covered in blood and dirt. But I ended up winning that race. And that was like my first major international win in 2011.
And the reason why I brought that one up for the listeners and the sake of the listeners is you're going to see kind of a trend and a pattern here all the way up to his last race. And I can't emphasize enough when Connor and I speak off the record, we do some work with some athletes together. One of the things I always say is it's amazing what people can do through adversity, especially when they're not expecting it. And you'll even see me on social media. I'll say quite often a true champion gets up one more time than they get knocked down. But when you see the mental tenacity of someone that goes 1-6-1 and it's not their fault, that's a completely different characteristic than just had an off race, which we're going to get into here. When we jump over to 2012, this is the first of three appearances that Connor's had at the Olympic level. That year in 2012, the Olympics were in London, where he picked up a seventh place. Also in 2012, one of nine appearances at the UCI World Championship level. He picked up first place in the time trial there in 2012, did it again in 13, did it again in 15. And you can see out of nine appearances, it's pretty amazing between the World Championships, the winnings. I'm going to go back here. We talked about 2015 at the World Championships. He moves on to 2016 for his second appearance at the Olympics. Doesn't just go there. He just goes and stamps a gold medal. First time it's ever been done in American history that we won a gold medal at the Olympics. We fast forward another 4 years, his third round of Olympics. And Connor, I was talking to you before we went on the show here tonight. I only have one other friend that's ever made the Olympics three times, and that's Hunter Kemper in the sport of triathlon. And speaking with him, I've never met somebody that's such a mental monster. And the idea that you've been on that world platform three times we're going to dive into some of the nuts and bolts here. Yeah. 2020 for Connor was the Summer Olympics in Tokyo. And unfortunately,
21. It was postponed, remember? It was postponed.
That's right.
2021.
Thank you so much. And unfortunately, that round of Olympics ended up for Connor, ended up with him being taken out during a qualifying race and was severely injured. And Connor, I'm not going to dig deep into that. I'm going to let you kind of elaborate as to what happened there. I'm always going to keep it top level, not that it's confidential information, but that was your third and final Olympics. Would you like to elaborate as to the magnitude of your injuries there?
Sure, absolutely. I also think, you know, at least for the story, for the arc, so people can understand if you're not familiar with BMX racing.
Yeah.
You mentioned I got seventh place in London in 2012, but I was actually the number one qualifier, number one seed in the final. And for all intents and purposes, I was the favorite, the betting odds favorite. I should have won. The final thing that if you go on YouTube, the NBC commentator, the final thing that they say is, I'm going to put my money on Fields.
Mm.
And so then I just you know, for lack of a better way to put it, I just blew it. I choked, right? I was 19. I was a kid. I just graduated high school the year before, and now I'm, you know, the number one seed in the Olympic final, right? And not really anything you can do to prepare yourself for that moment. So that was tough, right? So then bouncing back and getting it done in 16 meant even more after that.
Absolutely.
But then, yeah, in Tokyo, after, you know, a year of uncertainty that everybody was dealing with, whether it was health concerns, finances, job, you know, how am I going to train? My gym's shut. How am I going to ride? The track's locked down. My entire event calendar is blown up, you know, and then with the Olympics being a major international competition that quite literally every country in the world competes in, you know, it's a little bit more than just organizing a race in a state that the laws might allow you to organize a race at that time, right? It's a bit bigger of a deal than that, right? And then Japan, to make it even worse, where the Olympics was one of the most strict countries in the world, and they're a small island. So they were like, we don't want all these people coming here. So that was a tough year to go through for, you know, all parties involved. But eventually we get there, we start racing. I advanced through the quarterfinals, number one seed. You know, in the semifinals, it was a best of three, and it was in the third semifinal that the accident happened. You know, I performed well enough in the first and second semifinal that I still qualified for the final, even though I was unable to compete. So I got eighth, technically. I got eighth in a DNF last part, technically. But I broke ribs, collapsed along, tore ligaments in my shoulder, tore my bicep, and I had a traumatic brain injury, resulting in brain bleeds on my frontal lobe and parietal lobe and injury to my corpus callosum and brain stem. It was very close to just being dead on impact. You know, face first into asphalt at 35 miles an hour. And, you know, as crazy as everything lined up for it to be that bad, it also lined up for me to be able to make a full recovery with no lasting effects. So, you know, after 12 months of rehabilitation between, you know, going to neurological rehab, relearning balance, repassing my driver's test, you know, all those steps to get your mind right, then shoulder reconstruction and everything that comes with that, you know, I had a decision to make. All right, I'm 2 years out now. Like, I was 15 minutes away from potentially winning a gold medal again. Do I really want this to be, you know, the way that I go out? And I was young enough to go again. And, you know, being that close, like working for 5 years and being 15 minutes away and then having it taken away from you, like, it was a racing incident, you know, so due to no fault of my own, it was a really hard thing to kind of juggle. And
sure,
with it for a little bit, and then I ultimately decided to retire on my own terms and walk away. And you know, it's one of those things where, like, I raced BMX for 22 years and I don't remember my final race. But I get to be healthy and have a life for the rest of my days, and that's what I decided was more important than, you know, winning another race. But it's like, also, that competitive nature is what gets you to that point. So you're like, oh, I could win again, you know, but you got to know when to tap out sometimes.
Yep. And I don't want to brush over the magnitude of that injury by any stretch to the imagine, but I do want to go back to London when you said that you choked. And I would encourage everybody, for all of the races that we're talking about, you can get them all on YouTube. The one in Tokyo, you got to have a strong stomach to watch that. I'm going to forewarn you, if you haven't seen the video, it's not for the lighthearted. It's brutal. And I just want to forewarn you guys, out of respect to Connor, yes, I think it's cool to see. And knowing what you've heard so far and then to actually see it on the YouTube channel and knowing what's going through his head, right? Number one, everything's coming together. Possible first time, not only the first guy in America to win a gold medal, but to be able to repeat it. I mean, think about it. Talk about redefining history. When you go back to that London, when you got seventh, did you just mistime the gate? Did you get pushed out in the first turn? What, when you say you choked, not from what we can see on YouTube, but from Connor in his brain, elaborate on what you meant by choking.
Yep. So BMX racing is so star dependent, and you have to be damn near perfect,
yep,
you know, at level, right? When you're at the Olympic level, if you're off by 5% on your start, like, your race is over before it begins. And not saying that you can't come back, but it's really hard. yep. at that level because you're racing against the theoretically seven other best athletes in the world, right? So unless they make a mistake, you're probably not going to have much room to move. But, you know, part of the process in the next couple of years after that experience was figuring out, what did I do wrong? And kind of what I got to, you know, through working with a sports psychologist was that from the time that you set a goal, right? And I guess I'll back it up and I'll explain when I set the goal. I watched the Olympics in 2008. That's where BMX racing made its Olympic debut. I was 15. I'd already been racing for 8 years. You know, I was already nationally ranked for 15-year-olds. I watched the Olympics on TV and I was so inspired and I was so motivated. That the next day I had a little gym in my garage. My parents had provided me with a rack and some weights, things that I would use. And I had posters of my favorite pros up on the wall and things like that. But the next day I grabbed a Sharpie and I wrote on the wall that one day I was going to win the Olympics. I got grounded for it, but my parents were like, hey, look, he's not out drinking. He's not out, you know, getting into trouble. He's working out 5-6 days a week in the garage, trying to achieve something great. So yes. We're going to like support him on this. Just made very clear, no more writing on the wall.
Fair enough.
But I guess what I came to after working with the sports psych was that from that moment on, I was always looking ahead. Everything was looking forward with that goal in mind. Every training session, even every race, right? Like World Cup, national championships, it was all in mind that this is a stepping stone to get to the goal, right? Then you get to that goal, and I continued that same kind of thought process of looking ahead. And so I'm sitting there behind the starting line for the Olympic final, thinking about how great it's going to feel to win and how I'm going to be, you know, the first American gold medalist. And I can't wait to get home and party. And like, I continue to look forward instead of being focused on the moment and just doing all of the steps that were going to give me the best chance of success, executing at my best, having my best start, hitting my marks, you know, focusing on myself, tuning everything out, like the things that are going to help you to do that. I continued that process of looking ahead.
Okay.
Stop. So then I had to, you know, for the next 4 years, I learned how to balance the two. And I would do it on a micro scale where, let's just use the national championships as an example, which is a big race for sure. But on the scale, it goes Olympics, world championships, world cups, Pan American Games, national championships, right?
Yep.
In our world, it's the fifth biggest race you could have. So you kind of use it as a tester. And so the idea was like, all right, cool. I'm going to work towards this goal that I've set. But then when I get to that day, I'm going to get really present and I'm not going to look forward anymore. And so I continued to use those other events as, I guess, mental training to hone my mindset, hone my mental game to where when I got to the day of the Olympics, which there's nothing you could do to prepare yourself for. There's nothing similar to it. So I could use all of these as mock races, but there's no such thing as the real deal. Mm-hmm. That I would be in the best mindset, have the best chance to just execute on the day. And so that was, you know, really what those 4 years were about. And then all the work paid off on the day.
Without giving away all of your secrets, because I know you do a lot of mental coaching. For those of you that follow us on the moto side of things, Connor's very influential on the moto side, as you can tell here, even early in our conversation. Mental edge. Would you mind elaborating only on what you're comfortable with and sharing? When you're on that gate, how did you stop yourself? And I'm sure this didn't happen the day of the Olympics. I'm not insinuating that, but like, how did you practice saying, okay, let's not get caught up in the next five races that are coming up over the next 3 months? How did you get yourself to say, okay, I'm on the gate right here. The only thing that I can focus on is what is immediately in front of me for the next 40 seconds.
Well, I guess how did you do that? I don't mind sharing, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, why hold it secret? You know, it's not like I've reinvented the wheel. It's not like I have some proprietary thing that nobody's ever heard of before.
Sure.
But I think that I hate when people gatekeep that stuff.
Amen.
It can help someone.
Yep.
The two things that come to mind. So number one, I read a book that was suggested to me called The Way of the Peaceful Warrior.
Okay.
Never heard of it. It's a good book. And in that book, there's a quote and the warrior asks himself, where are my feet? And that's a way of bringing yourself back to the present moment. you can use it in any situation, whether it's stress at work, you're at a race, the gym, whatever it is. Where are my feet? My feet are right here. There's nothing else that I could do except for be right here, right now. So when I would go to other places, or I would be racing in Texas, thinking about the race next week in Florida, I would just literally, like, sometimes out loud ask myself, where are my feet? My feet are here. This is all I can do. Okay. And then the second thing, this is something that was taught to me by a psychologist, was it's okay to go there. Just make sure you come back, right? So, of course, if you want to go through 4 years of training for the Olympics, right? Like, that is a very long commitment. And I don't think, and you'll understand this, but I don't think most people don't understand that the process begins 3 years and 11 months out. Like, it's not, you know, it's not something that the year of the Olympics, like, all right, here we go. Like,
absolutely.
Qualifying just to make the team begins 2 years out from the Olympics. So that means that your prep to get ready for the qualifying begins a year before that, right? And so there's a lot more to it. So the idea of going through those 4 years and not sitting around daydreaming about winning the Olympics is not going to happen.
Yeah. Right?
Of course, when you're sitting there doing hypertrophy, 10 sets of 10 with 2 minutes break, you know, your legs are on fire and your heart rate spiked and you want to chop your legs off because they're burning so bad. Of course, you're going to think about winning the Olympics and how good it's going to feel. And that's okay. Go there. Just make sure that you come back, right? And so you have to have those goals and those visions and see yourself on the podium, see yourself holding the plate, see yourself doing that. But come back to where your feet are right now, right? And that's what I didn't do looking at what happened in London at my first Olympics. I was on the starting hill thinking about the after party, and I didn't come back to the starting hill to execute my start. I was still at the after party when the gate drops.
That makes sense. Now, for those people who follow us in the moto world, this is exactly what McAdoo's wife said to him: be where your feet are. Do you do any work with McAdoo, or is that just a coincidental thing?
Great coincidental. I like him. Great guy. You know, Christian Craig's the one I've worked with the most. And then Avery Long, who's going to be coming up in the next year or two. He just tore his ACL about 6 months ago, 5-6 months ago. But he won 450, or no, on Pro Sport, I think, at Minios.
Okay.
Right before his injury. So he's coming. And then Luca Marcellisi as well, who's made himself a main event regular on the East Coast this year.
Nice. And Avery, he's on the NSA Yamaha team, correct?
Yep.
Okay. Yep, that's what I thought it was.
Good family.
I remember. Now, again, I don't want to kind of breeze through all of this. When we look at the trials and the tribulations, and you go back to, like, even the Pan American Games, chain breaks, you still have all these rankings and stuff like that. One of the things that you brought up several times, even early in our conversation here, is it's literally impossible to do a race day simulation where you can put that much, I hate to use the word pressure because I don't really believe in pressure, not in a non-traditional way, but that's outside the scope of what we're talking about today. But what would you recommend for somebody who is maybe a parent that has a young athlete, or maybe somebody that's 15 to 18 years old and they're kind of in that sweet spot of really hitting it big time? What do you recommend to athletes? What do you recommend to individuals? What would you recommend to parents to help them get? How do you create an environment that's literally impossible to emulate?
Yeah. So I think the first thing that I would say is, like, you have to understand that it's impossible to emulate the exact thing, right?
Yeah.
So if you go into it thinking I'm going to create the same environment and make everything the same, like, you're going to fail before you begin. But you can work elements of it, or you could work pieces of it, or you could work at a higher rate between, you know, your average day of training and then the biggest event that it is for you. You can find a sweet spot somewhere in the middle to get closer to it.
Right.
You know, so I guess one of the things that evolved with me and my training and my program over the years was I continued to make each individual day as high level and high pressure as I possibly could, to make race day not seem like it was anything more than or greater than just a normal Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there's always going to be those extra elements, right? Because on Tuesday, we're not racing for thousands of dollars, right? There's not somebody trying to kill me on Tuesday.
Yeah.
you know, surrounding myself with other hard workers and training partners was a really big one, and people who they viewed it the same way as I did. And we all brought different things to the table, but we just pushed each other. We worked hard. I mean, I had some of the biggest fights that I ever had with some of my best friends in training because we were pushing each other. But on race day, I'm rooting for him and he's rooting for me just as hard as possible, you know?
Absolutely.
Doing other things like creating scenarios where we're going to do a mock race this weekend. We're 2 weeks out, so we're going to do a mock race this weekend. And, you know, loser buys lunch, you know? And it's just something as simple as, a little lunch bet that ups that ante a little bit.
Absolutely. You
know, or figuring things out, or just continuing to push and make everybody kind of, it's like that iron sharpens iron mentality. And then really just supporting each other through it, right? Like, we all understand, and again, this is a lot easier as you get older, but
sure,
I'll preface by saying it's easy when you get older, but that's why when you're dealing with younger athletes, it's so much more important for the coach or coaches to set the tone.
Yep.
But finding people who, you know, I'll push you, you push me, but at the end of the day, I've got your back and you've got mine.
Absolutely.
I'm not going to hold any secrets. If I see something that you could improve, I will help you. I know you will do the same. If you say, hey, Connor, you know, you're being you have an attitude today, get it together. I'm not going to take it personally because I know that it's coming from a place of support and love.
Absolutely.
Right? That, like, if there's a race that I'm not attending, I'm going to watch and support you because the day that I'm racing and you're not, I want you to do the same. And so it's kind of having that band of brothers mentality, just surrounding yourself with good people.
I like what you just said there with the band of brothers. You and I have talked about this offline. I'm very fortunate. Nathan Glab out of Australia with Glab's coaching. He's a BMX pro in Australia. He uses all of our performance services, you know, core body temperature, blood lactate, you know, CGM monitors. He has a very unique approach to BMX. And he's very fortunate. You know, he's got some world ranking athletes underneath his stable, and he has quite a few young and developing. One of the things that he and I always talk about is trying to cultivate an environment of accountability and responsibility. Would you say that, like you were talking about, when you put that small tribe around you, does it contribute? I know I don't want that to sound like a Captain Obvious statement, but is that buying of lunch, do you feel that it falls into that environment of accountability? Like, how would you, like,
I think the accountability isn't even on that scale. The accountability is like, it begins, if you show up late, like, then you're letting the team down.
Yes.
Simple as that. If you show up and you brought a snack and you didn't bring a snack for the crew, you didn't show up, right? Like, you know, it's something as simple as, you know, every day when I brought a power bar or something, I would bring extra in case somebody needed one.
Certainly.
Someone's going to forget, you know what I mean? It's that accountability level there. Or, you know, if somebody's slacking, if they're just going through the motions, you call them out on it, right? It doesn't even have to be a bet or a monetary value or anything like that. It's just the accountability begins the minute that you guys, you know, agree that we're going to work together. And with the athletes that I coach, I've got a handful of Olympic hopeful athletes that I'm helping. And I explain that, like, you guys, when I'm not there, you guys have to self-police and work and help each other out. And if there's an issue, you know, I'll step in. But, you know, there's a race going on today in Houston, and I have them in a group chat. And obviously, I'll talk to them separately.
Sure.
About the individual, hey, you're doing this over this jump, or hey, choose this lane out of the gate next lap or whatever. But they're in a group chat because we are a team.
Yeah,
and if one makes the final and one doesn't, I want the guy who doesn't make the final to be there at the back of the starting gate saying, you got this, brother, let's go.
Sure.
Conversely, just to build that up.
I love the accountability on both the good and the bad side. Like you said, you've got a bad attitude, somebody holds you accountable. It's more to help you than just kick your feet out from underneath you. This is what Nathan Glab, I think, does better than almost anyone I've seen. And that is the idea that, this is, I don't want to put words in Nathan's mouth. This is my opinion. If you want to be the next deadbeat, hang around four other deadbeats. If you want to be the next world champion, hang around four. Now, by the way, it doesn't have to be a world champion in the sport that you love. But like you said, having that accountability and responsibility, this is what Nathan really cultivates when he goes to the track. all the older athletes are responsible for the younger athletes. You know, if you see the young athlete making a mistake, you don't just skate by it. You stop and you say something, because as Johnny Hopper says, a rising tide lifts all boats, right? And I love it. Did you refer to it as a tribe? Is that how you said it? It's kind of like your posse's all together?
Yeah, and we didn't have a word for it or whatever. Okay. You know, it's just the crew or, you know, however you...
Yes. Yeah. Well, I just think that crew mentality where it's about the accountability. Hey, you're doing a good job, or hey, you're being a total pinhead today. But the end result is still everybody wants to get the best out of each other. And that I do agree with you. It seems to be it's more, as long as I'm the superior one, everything's cool. But as soon as you bridge that gap, all of a sudden I don't want to be friends anymore. Doesn't sound like that you guys didn't work in that environment. It was everybody was trying to push each other to that next. How many guys were in that crew, would you say, on a regular basis?
It rotated over the years, right?
Okay.
In the beginning, I was the young pup. And a lot of this was cultivated by my coach, the teachings that he taught me. But
sure,
young pup, and then I became the older established rider. And like now, you know, the one of the favorites for the next Olympics, he's an Australian kid. He took my spot on Chase.
Okay.
I've known him, and he's been part of the crew since he was 16. You know, he's 23 now. But, you know, you're seeing the rewards now of what he learned and experienced when he was a younger athlete. But what I will say, just because, you know, right now it all sounds hunky-dory, but what I will say is this. There was always a strategic, unspoken hierarchy, if that makes sense. And that was
absolutely
the coach designed it that way, because he's not going to bring in like my biggest competitor. Like that's never going to work.
Yeah.
He would bring in the young pup to nip at my heels to push me, and then he could chase me and learn from me. Right. And then there would be the old savvy vet who was good, and he was good enough to push everybody, but we all knew that he was never going to take my spot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there was a little bit of like organization within the team, but everybody just wanted the best for each other. I don't think it would have changed because we had a good relationship off the track too. But it never happened where like somebody got like pipped in the hierarchy and then we had to see how that worked. Right.
Sure.
We didn't know. Like I got beat. Sure. Everybody got beat sometimes. But we didn't have to deal with that. But, you know, on top of that, too, it's one of those things where, like, the relationship didn't end when we left the track. Like, we were all going out to dinners together, you know, off the record. We were going to the bars together. I mean, you know, we had a good relationship. We're there. Like, these were, like, they're your brothers, you know?
Yes.
We've got stories on the track, and we've got stories off the track, you know? And that's the where it all stems from.
The thing that I like about the conversation so far today is, yeah, you're there doing physical work, but there's that, I think, until you get to the tip of the spear, people don't realize how much that mental integration of perspective, outlook, accountability, go there with purpose, go there prepared, go there looking out for others. Like you said, it was you and five other guys, you brought 6 power bars or 10 power bars, because that you may be that guy one day that just, you thought you threw it in your bag and you didn't, and you're like, hey, thanks, Tim. Thanks for bringing me something. You know, I forgot mine. I think that goes a long way, but when you start getting into that elite level, all of a sudden you start to realize how powerful the mental aspect of it is. And that was one of the reasons why I was so thankful that you agreed to come on the show, because what I find so, one of the most enjoyable parts of my job is how many people will reach out. They're in a dark part. They're in a dark spot, excuse me. And they're, you know, they'll reach out, hey, how did you get through this? As many people know, I was married for 25 years, went through a very long, lengthy, painful divorce. I can't tell you many people will reach out and say, how did you fill in the blank? How did you not get bitter? How did you not become an alcoholic? How did you? But when you're dealing with elite level performance, that's why I was so thankful that you'd be willing to come on, because whether you're getting ready for the Olympics and you're overcoming, your chain came off and you've got to get it back together, it requires that ability to hit reset, refocus, and then execute. And I always say, and Connor, I have to give you credit for this, how many times you've told me, it's like, hey, on race day, thinking stopped and it's all about execution. Like you said, you just didn't execute on the day and you ended up with 7th. And it's crazy to think that the average person would be, of course, you're not average, but the average person would be thankful to make a round of Olympics. You're irritated that you didn't win it. And again, it just shows the difference. You know, that's why we say there's champion and champion habits. There's champions and champion mindset. And that's why I wanted to have you on today talking about that mindset.
There's on that same note, you know, people ask me about the Olympics. I always like to explain there's two different kinds of athletes.
Yes.
There's the athletes that making the Olympics was their, right? Now, if you think about every sport, every team, you know, whether it's field hockey, swimming, whatever it is, if there's 20 athletes that are competing or 30 athletes, BMX is 32, or they're in, let's say, field hockey or a team sport, water polo, you know, say there's 12 teams.
Sure.
Of all those teams, there's some that absolutely know that they could do their best and their best is 10th place. Like, they're never going to go better, especially if you're in a time sport like swimming or track and field or javelin, shot put, measurable, tangible things.
Yep.
You can have your best shot put of your life and you might get 15th place.
Mm.
Right. So for those athletes, their goal was to make the games.
Yep.
And then box is ticked. They're there having fun. You see them taking pictures, trading pins. They're having a blast.
Like, that's a good point.
In every sport, there's four to six, maybe athletes, teams that if they execute, they have a good shot at going home with a medal, right? And, you know, the teams and athletes that get fourth, fifth, sixth, that kills because you're so close to going home with a trophy. But the person who gets fourth is the same as the person who gets 30th. It's all the same.
Yep.
Literally, a participation certificate.
Yep.
And so, you know, I explain that to people, and like, you can see the difference when you're in the dining hall. Some athletes are there just having the time of their life, and then the smaller percentage is sitting there trying to eat, you know, three bites of oatmeal in the morning because they're so nervous.
Absolutely. That's a good point. And one of the things I think is most interesting is, and this is more of a question for you, When did that transition go from, okay, I'm 15, expert, I'm killing it, I'm, you know, let's, you're not being cocky, you're one of the best in the country at 15 years old, this opportunity for the Olympics comes around, at what age did you start to realize that you could possibly make a career out of this? I know there's a lot of changes, right? Finally, BMX got into the Olympics, that was cool. One of the things that I don't think is relevant to our conversation, but hopefully prize money was getting a little bit better, bike salaries, there were more sponsors where you could actually make a living. At what point, again, from your head, where were you at? When did you have that mental epiphany? I could make a living at doing this.
I mean, I think there's a few things to think about. When you're 15 years old, you don't understand what a living is, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember I got my first prize money and I made $300 and I thought I was rich. You know, my dad loves this story. The first, like, I did a pro-am. It was just a money dash. We drove down to Phoenix for a money dash. I think I got second or third. I made $300. He said, oh, cool, let me see that. He counted and he took $150 and put it in his pocket. I said, what the heck, Dad? Well, that's gas and dinner. Do you want me to bill you for the hotel too? And I couldn't believe it. You know, now that I'm older, I look back, like, even if he took all $300, he was going to lose money traveling down.
Absolutely.
All that. But, you know, it's just an example. Like, you don't understand, you know, when you're a kid and you make 10 grand, you think that you're rich, right? When you're older, you understand that 30% is knocked off the top right away for taxes.
Sure.
We have insurance, we've got bills, we've got, you know, all the realities of life. So I guess I wasn't even thinking about the financial piece of it. I just was trying to be a pro. Like, right, as a kid, all I wanted to do was be a pro. I wanted to be sponsored and, you know, have the big checks and like, that was what I wanted to do. I would say when I was about 16, that was the first time that I won the national championships. It was for 16-year-olds.
Okay.
Between the ages of, you know, 8 when I started and 15, I was good, not great. I would never have been the one that they circled and said, that's going to be the guy. I was always a couple places behind the ones that were circled saying, that's going to be the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Ripping at their heels, chasing them, trying to catch up. 16, puberty hit. I was taking it more seriously earlier than other people. That was when I kind of was like, all right, I got a shot at this. And then what I did, I mentioned it earlier, my first ever World Cup. My very first World Cup was 2009. The year after the Beijing Olympics, and I got third place there, and I beat the Olympic silver and bronze medalists who were American at the time.
Wow.
They were 25, 26 years old. And I did that in my first try. And then I went to school Monday. And then, but it was in that moment that I think I and everybody else was like, okay, this kid's got something here, right? He just started shaving last week and he's already beating these guys.
Mm-hmm.
That was really it. And then I just honed in on London, made it to London. And then, you know, after that was when like the sponsors started rolling in. And then I started to understand, you know, because when I would, again, I have to give a ton of credit to my father. He was fantastic. I graduated high school in 2010. He said, I will support you for 2 years through London. You can live here rent free. I'm going to support you through London. I graduated at 17. Just normal high school, not homeschool or anything like that. It's traditional. Yep. But after London, you're going to be on your own, right? You either have to make money doing this or you're going to have to get a job to support, but I'm not just going to, you know, bankroll you for life.
Yep.
And so he did that. He supported me. He let me live for free, you know, helped me when I needed it to get through London. I got home from London. About a month later, he sits me down at the dinner table and he has a manila folder. He opens the folder and he said, here's your phone bill. Here's your car insurance bill. Here's, you know, I'm going to need that gas card back from you.
Yep.
And you want to live here. It's going to be $300 a month and rent's going to be due on the first. And I, at this time, I think I was making like 75 grand or something a year.
Okay.
I'm living at home thinking I'm rich, right? Because I'm just save. And I just remember being so shocked at what just happened. But I really appreciate that because I learned a lot. And then I started to have to treat it like a job, like a business. I had to learn, you know, that same year, I got my 1099 and all of a sudden I owed 30% back and I didn't have it because I didn't know.
Yes.
So, you know, I had to learn, you know, how to do all that stuff. So I learned the hard way, but I had good guidance.
When you look at what your dad did, he's given you an end date. When you look at the Olympics, you know, they announced that the next round of Olympics is going to be at this venue, at this date. You have a definitive, I'm here today. I've got exactly X amount of days before the next round of Olympics. With all of my athletes, I always preach to them the concept of Parkinson's law of time. If you give me a project, Connor, and you say, Rob, you've got 3 weeks to fill it or finish it, I'll probably take nearly all 3 weeks. But if you give me that same project and you say, I need it done in a week, ironically, I probably can get it done in a week. I love what your dad did because, all right, 2 years to London after 2 years. So without, you know, boom, he put a definitive end date. There it is. You're still focusing on the Olympics and all that you're doing. And your dad's thinking, all right, when that comes, when you look at all of the deadlines that you've met, and I think this is one of the coolest things about athletics, right? When you're racing, it sounds obviously being on the West Coast, you were ABA guy. You know, you knew when those ABA Grand Nationals were going to be. You knew the location as the season transpires, you know your biggest competition is every weekend. The Grands come or the Grand Nationals come. Then you move into the, like you say, World Championships. Then you're moving in Pan American. Then you're doing Olympic trials. Then you make the Olympics themselves. It's what I love about athletics is how much it emulates the challenges of life. When you've got a drop dead date, that date's coming whether you're ready or not. That calendar keeps ticking. 24 hours is up.
All of things, triple 15th is going to come every year.
Absolutely. And of all of those deadlines that you were given, whether it was your dad saying, hey, look, I'm paying, I'll support you until then. When you look at the trials, Olympics round one, Olympics round two, Olympics round three, which was the most difficult one that you had to, like when your dad pulled that manila folder out, obviously it left an indelible mark because you remember it vividly. Of all of those hard deadlines that you had to meet, which one do you think was the most difficult one to achieve? Because it's easy on this side to go, hey, you made three rounds of Olympics. Awesome. That date came. We go to YouTube. We watch you perform. Great. Good job. Which one was the hardest for you to get ready for?
It's hard for me to pick one because they were all challenging in different ways.
Okay.
London, my very first one was challenging because it wasn't challenging. It came easy in some ways.
Yeah,
yes. I worked hard. I had a gift and I started winning way sooner than anybody expected, right? But having to navigate what that meant when I wasn't equipped. I was 18 years old during most of the qualification process. I was living with mom and dad, just graduated high school. You know, I didn't have the tools necessary to deal with how quickly it ramped up.
Yeah.
Going from, you know, 2 years ago, I was literally racing amateurs, eating hot dogs, hanging out with my friends, watching the pros, right? And then, you know, you like blink, and all of a sudden now I'm getting phone calls from Sports Illustrated wanting an interview, or I'm in New York City on the Today Show. And like, it just happened so quick. And I was in a whirlwind, essentially.
Sure.
So that was challenging in that regard. I don't think I even recognized at the time that it was challenging. But looking back, I was thinking to myself, because I talk to like 18-year-old kids now. I'm like, I was doing, when you're eight, I was doing that when I was your age. Like, I look back, I made some dumb comments, said some dumb things. Like, I was 18.
Right? Yep.
But physically, that was the easiest one because everything just happened really naturally. Rio was hard because everything was going great. And then April 1st, April Fool's Day of that year, I broke my wrist.
No.
I broke my scaphoid and it went avascular. And I had to have a bone graft. Missed Olympic trials, missed most of the training. I only had 8 weeks to ride before the games, and my wrist was still technically broken at the games. So physically, that was the hardest. Mentally it was the hardest during the injury, and then during competition it was the easiest because I was just happy to be there.
Sure.
Like, I'm here, cool, I got a broken wrist, I guess I go for it now.
Yep.
And then with Tokyo, it would have been a lot easier, I think, because I had so much more experience. I was mature. I was 27 years old. Like, I have, you know, the life experience just makes things more manageable.
Sure.
I also understand that if I win or if I lose, the sun comes out tomorrow, which I didn't understand when I was 19. However, that was when COVID got thrown in the mix and having to navigate that. Is the Olympics going to happen? Is it not? How are they going to do the qualifying when there's no races? Like,
yeah.
All of the things that came with that challenge. So they're all challenging in different ways. So it's really hard for me to pick which one was the most challenging.
That makes sense. Yeah. With that being said, you know, when you're overcoming these types of these adversities, some of which are obviously, you know, when the whole world shut down, I don't think many people put into perspective, you've just trained for 4 years of your life and either A, it's not going to happen, or B, it's going to get pushed out. And it's not easy to take that peak fitness and just bump it out another 4 to 5 months. I don't know that everybody understands the scope of that. That's called periodization in the fitness world. And
it wasn't even 4 to 5 months. It was a full year.
Exactly. The only reason why I was saying 4 to 5 months is the idea that, let's say that they go ahead and they push out another date, you've got to kind of reset, do another rebuild. And people just don't understand. It's not like, hey, we could just reschedule this and everybody's going to be perfectly fit 12 months later. It's so much harder than that. When we zoom back out, obviously you've had a lot of success, tremendous amounts of success. You've also, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, I would assume you've had quite a few tribulations, right? It's easy to, as the old saying goes, everybody looks at YouTube and looks at all the success, but nobody knows those dark, you know, those difficult days. What was the most disappointing race for you out of all of the ones that you've had, from obviously the three Olympics, the biggest platform that anybody can relate to, all the way down to maybe, you know, your disappointment getting beat at the local track for the first time? What was the most painful, most difficult one you've had to go through that you're comfortable discussing?
Yeah, I'll talk about all of them, right? And I think a couple of things to mention before I answer that. Number one is, and when I do my corporate keynote speaking and I speak to businesses and companies and associations,
yeah,
I joke about how I raced thousands of races, tens of thousands of races in my life, but people really only care about three.
Yep.
Right. And so I talk about handling pressure, like, you better get one of those three correct, if you know what I mean.
Because sure,
realistically, I did tons of races, but nobody cares about those ones to the same level.
Sure.
But as far as like the hardest one, I say hard, but like people ask me, would you change? What would you redo? Would you rerun any races? And the answer is no, because I like the way everything turned out.
Okay.
Sure. If you could guarantee me that you change the result of this one race, it doesn't have a butterfly effect and it doesn't change anything else, then absolutely. But I genuinely believe that each race happened and it continued to shape me into the athlete that I was, which continued to shape the career that I was able to have. So I wouldn't change it. London was hard because it was a big letdown and I had nobody to blame but myself. But the hardest race, which actually kind of ended up being the best race at the same time,
okay,
was 2014 UCI World Championships in Holland. And as I had mentioned before, I was really working on honing in my mental game.
Mm-hmm.
The years before, 2012 and 13, I won the time trial world champion. So I was coming in looking for a three-peat in that. 2014 was the worst season that I had as a professional. I, for whatever reason, it just was my worst results that I ever had.
Okay.
So I had a real rough season up until this. I got ninth in the time trials, not even close. Mm. Had a huge mental breakdown that night. And, you know, barely got any sleep. And then the next day, I actually was talking to my mom, and it was one of those nights that, like, I didn't need sports. Like, I just needed my mom to tell me that, you know, it's going to be okay. I love you type thing.
Sure.
And that next day was the absolute best and most mentally sharp I think I have ever been. Coming in as the 9 seed, I won my qualifiers, my quarterfinal. I won the semifinal. I was the number 1 seed again in the final, very similar 2 years later to what happened in London. This time I executed the start. I was out in front. I was at the halfway point, and I got taken out by the guy behind me. And when in the blink of an eye, I make the joke, I entered the turn with $100,000. I came out with $300 and a broken something, whatever it was, finger. And, you know, it happened so fast. Yeah. And it was like the most devastating, you know, soul-crushing loss you could have. It was also my arch rival who took me out and won. I mean, there was like layers and layers to why it was so painful.
Sure. I'm sorry, Connor. This is after a bad 2015.
14.
Going in
14.
No, 14. Okay.
Horrible first half of the season in 14.
Gotcha.
World Cup in July. That was when it happened. You know, horrible event. However, that race made me believe that I could get in the big final and execute.
Mm-hmm.
That race made me believe that I could do it. Even though I didn't cross the finish line, I was literally halfway there. And that like mental learning from that event, I didn't realize it till later, but that's what kind of turned the career back on track and ramped everything up from then on pretty much. So it's like, of course, I wish I would have, you know, covered the inside a little more that turn and not been taken down, but I learned so much from it.
If we could pull that computer chip out of your brain and print out all of the thought processes, when you say at that point, that's when the big momentum shift took place, looking back at it so many years later, what does that actually look like? What does that consist of?
I would say that that raises what taught me that, like, I could control my mind and my thoughts weren't going to control me, because I shifted from the night before having a big mental breakdown, which typically, historically, would have been it, right? I was toast. Rest of the event, I was going to be done. However, I flipped it around and went from having one of my worst days to having my best day. And all just the shift was within myself. Nobody said anything. I mean, my mom said stuff, I'm sure, but I did it. And so what really taught me was I can control my mindset. I can control my thoughts. And that was the big learning piece. And so then everything I did moving forward came from a standpoint of I'm the captain of this ship. I'll point it whatever direction I want to go. That doesn't mean I don't have challenges. I didn't have challenges and didn't have times where it didn't go well. But that learning, I guess, stayed with me.
If we had the ability to go and look at for those of you that don't follow cycling, we measure power. We take body weight in kilograms. We factor that in with how many watts you can generate with your legs. We refer to that as watts per kilogram. If I were to go, like that day that you had that mental epiphany, if I could take all of your physical data, your FTP functional training power, I could take your max wattage, I could take your average wattage for a sustained, let's call 3, 5, 10, 15 seconds. Would you say that you were the fittest, fastest, strongest guy? You're talking about the mental epiphany, but if we were to take and extrapolate the physical capabilities, would you be comfortable saying you were, if not the fittest, strongest, fastest guy at that time?
Compared to myself or compared to the other athletes?
To the other athletes.
Hard to say in BMX racing. I guess a couple things that come to mind. Number one, I was 21 years old, and I was also competing against at the time, the current Olympic gold medalist was like 27.
Gotcha.
So just the natural physical, of course he could squat more than me. He had 6 more years of base training.
Absolutely.
I was young, right? Like I look at pictures of myself there and then pictures of myself in 2021, I don't even look like the same person.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think I was, but then on top of that, BMX is a weird one where sometimes the best guy isn't on paper the strongest, but his efficiency of transferring what he has physically through the bicycle is better than somebody who might be physically stronger, but they lose on their pedaling technique or they lose on their starting technique or however they ride the bike. I don't know if I ever would have been the fittest if we did strictly off the bike testing.
Yeah.
But I also think that that was a mistake that a lot of trainers in our sport and in a lot of sports make, is they get so focused in the lab and the off the field of play stuff that they lose sight of everything in the lab and everything in the gym and everything off of the field of play or racetrack or whatever you're doing is meant to be a supplement to make you better at what you're actually trying to do. I would rather have worse numbers in the lab if that makes me go faster. Mm-hmm. Nobody gets paid, for their lab work.
Yes. And the reason why I wanted to ask you that question is I want the listeners to understand that the entire time you were talking about that breakthrough race, it was you speaking with your mom, having a mental meltdown, and then having that mental epiphany. Never once did you talk about fitness. And I think so many people, they underestimate how powerful mental capacity is. And I know you're the guru of it. I know you've really got this down to a science. I know you've helped so many people. And I just think it's incredibly powerful because, unfortunately, and I've read this for numerous years, how many times has the American human performance world been given credit on generating, new physiological advancements? Let's just leave it that generically. But then they always say that the Americans lag on the mental. And then you go and you go against the Germans and all these other very, very mentally tough countries. And then we get slaughtered, not so much on physical capability, but mental toughness, the ability to focus, as you said, deliver on the day. That's why I wanted to hear what your perspective was on that, because everything that you said was all about the mental. And these are the types of questions that I get messages from on a regular basis, like, how would Connor Fields get through the trial and tribulation I'm in right now? It's not just about brute force and, effing ignorance. It's let's hit the pause button. Let's refocus. Let's reshape the situation that we're in. Let's look at the circumstances. It's not about trying to dodge the reality of what's going on. It's being able to handle it. And I love what you said. It's not about the person that could put up the best FTP numbers. It's a person that can execute it. I'm going to kind of embarrass you here a little bit because I've watched your replay at Rio de Janeiro probably 400,000 times. And I would encourage anybody who hasn't watched it to please do so. And there's a bunch of different ones that are out there. But the one that I love is as soon as you start the video, literally the gate's dropping. And you're in gate like 5 or 6 there. You're a little bit off as you're looking at the gate, you're off to the more of the left side. And you come out of turn number 1, you're in second place, you're behind your teammate. You come out of turn number 2, and he clips his rear wheel by just a nanosecond, and you do an incredible job. You stay low, and then he has to kind of huck a buck to try to clear it, gets into the last corner. He has somebody come up underneath him, pushes him out. You're gone. And the reason why I'm bringing it up, and it's not to embarrass you, if you watch where the camera angle changes, you're coming towards the camera, and you can just see your eyes laser-focused, as Connor's always are, and you stay nice and low, and you just butter the backside of the double. But my point is, and you're not going to like when I say this, and this is no disrespect to your fellow American, the distance between you and second place at the finish line was ridiculous. I teased with my wife. I think that's got to be, what, 8-9 bike lengths? And in the BMX world, that's like minutes in triathlon. I just want you guys to go back and watch it, because Connor's too humble. He won't give himself credit. That's why I was asking. And again, we did not rehearse this conversation. This is the first time we've talked about any of these subjects together. The reason why I wanted to have Connor on the show today is to talk about the power of the mental side of things, and how, yes, you've got to be physically fit and you've got to have fundamental skills, and then you've got to take those fundamental skills to the level that Connor did. But if you watch the race, it comes down to just a few little things. And then the finish result at the finish line, or the end result rather at the finish line, is staggering. Because it just, so for the sake of people who are not into BMX, look at the distance between Connor in second place, and then look at the distance between second and eighth place. It's like literally less than a second from second to eighth, but the distance between Connor is a full second. And in BMX world, like I said, that's minutes in the running or the endurance world. So mad props to you in that regards, man. It was very impressive to see there.
Like I said, it's that's one race, right? I've been on the other side of that too.
Absolutely. No, but like you said earlier, we could have this podcast together and people could hear you speak, and it's a tad bit nebulous if you're not really into it, right? But then if I could get them to take everything that you've just spent over an hour sharing with everybody and then literally just put it into one race. You know, it's not like you're asking somebody to watch an 8-hour triathlon. You're like, look, check this out. This is everything that's been talked about. Now, if you've stuck with us this far in the show, thank you so much. Do me a favor. And let's go back to the beginning of the show and let's go through all of the highs and the lows. I only recapped some of the high-profile races, right? The three Olympic being present at three different Olympics. Like I said to you earlier, 9 appearances at the World Championship. He's won 2 of them, 5-time national champion. Oh, it's real easy to go to the accolades page. It's easy to see all of the results. But the dark days, the night that you broke down and talked to your mom, can you imagine if we had a camera on that? I mean, nowadays with social media, a lot of it is a little bit more tangible. That's the part people don't see, is they see the gold medal win. They see the multiple championships. They see the Chase deal. They see the Monster deal. They see the end results and all the benefits, or, you know, the byproduct of all the hard work. But the emotional highs, the emotional lows, the rebuilding, getting injured. What is it with that little scaphoid bone? Every time somebody talks about it, what a nagging little bugger that one is, huh?
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Is it still buggy to this day?
I don't have full range of motion. I can't go down.
Okay.
But outside of shooting a basketball, you don't really ever need to go down.
Okay.
Rips. Like, I can go back, which is what you want.
Yeah.
But I'm a righty, so my basketball career is still good to go.
Good.
Thank goodness.
But I do have some, a lot of subscribers and listeners who are numbers junkies. Only if you're comfortable with sharing the numbers. What's the max you've ever put out on the Watt bike?
Oh, the most I've ever seen, I don't remember the exact, was 25-something.
Right. For those of you who don't understand, 2,500 watts is like almost superhuman. Like, if you put it like in, for those, most people can resonate like with a Lance Armstrong and cycling. You know, if Lance Armstrong is doing a 40K time trial, he might average on the high side 450 watts for 25K. 400 watts versus 2,500 watts. What's the most you've ever squatted?
Well, going to the watts, you got to remember too, though, it's what we train, right?
Absolutely. But I always like to put it in, put it in context.
I could hold 400 watts for probably 2 minutes and then I'm tanked. You know what I mean? Like,
When you say, oh, just 2,500, it comes across like, well, the average guy could do maybe 23, but I could hit 25. No, That's ridiculous. Like step brakes type power.
Cyclists are going to come anywhere near that. But you know, most elite BMXers have north of 25 watts per kilo.
Yeah, that's incredible.
North of that to get out of the starting gate. Most I've ever squatted was 415.
Okay.
I was always careful not to max out because there's no gain in it. I didn't want to run the risk of injury.
Yes.
You know, I probably could have gone north of that, but like that's just a, you know, meathead contest where I would rather just protect my back, protect everything. And I'll just, I did a lot of velocity based training. Everything I did was VBT. So
yep.
I was always doing, you know, moderate weights as fast as I could.
Absolutely. And again, I hope for the sake of the listeners, you guys realize our questions aren't staged. And if you've heard me on previous shows, how many times have I said, why am I adamantly against squatting, clean and jerk, snatch? Because the average individual doesn't have the functional flexibility to do it without weight, much less with weight. As you just heard Connor say, I'm not going to do something and get hurt. That's the difference between, like you say, somebody who's good and somebody who's a great. Well, before I let you go,
I'll add one thing as well.
Okay.
Something that I think could be helpful for the listeners. You view your body as a battery, and then you only have so much capacity, right? It's going to run out. What is the best possible use of this energy? And is the best possible use going to be squatting? And if so, is it going to be squatting heavy, squatting moderately, or is it technique work? You know, what is the best use?
Yeah.
And so, you know, for me with that battery, the idea of adding a shitload of weight, excuse my French.
Nope.
It wouldn't benefit me. My energy would have been better used doing something else. Now, I'm a big proponent of squats. I love squats. I think they're the granddaddy exercise, you know, squatting if you want to be strong, lower body, core, upper body, and then mentally too.
Yes.
And to back up, right? But, you know, figure out what is the best use for you. And I will also add, one of my favorite things about being at the Olympic Training Center is you'd be in the gym, and there was a day that I was sitting there squatting right next to the Olympic gold medalist shot putter, who is like 6'6", 260, 270, just a monster. And he was doing literally double what I was doing. But then down a couple racks down the way were, you know, high jumpers that were doing single leg pogos with just the bar. You know, like everybody was doing what worked for them in their sport and what they needed. And there's not a one size fits all. And you'd see some crazy stuff in there, but then they would explain to you why they did that, and you'd be like, oh, that makes sense.
And again, Connor and I have not rehearsed this conversation, and for anybody that I work with, what's the number one thing I say to you on a daily basis? If you don't understand why you're doing the workout, we need to be talking, because I failed you as a physiologist. Every workout has a purpose, and that purpose is indigenous to you, getting you where you want to go from where you're at now. And you just heard it from a three-time Olympian. You had mentioned earlier, Connor, that you're doing some TV stuff. I know you're doing some work with the Outdoor Network right there in Nevada.
Yeah, it's with PBS. So they have a show called Outdoor Nevada where we go all around the state and highlight cool outdoor activities.
That's very cool.
It's fun for me because it's stuff that I do already. Hiking, biking, fishing, you know, seeing waterfalls and different, you know, things like that, as well as highlighting really cool people. I think our next shoot, we're going to be with a biologist finding desert tortoises. So,
very cool.
It's a really fun way to explore the state, do new things. And it's also very active and fit and healthy. And it combines a lot of the things I do and don't.
That's your natural wheelhouse. Cause I know I see you and your wife, you guys like to hike and do all the stuff. So like you say, get paid for it. Is there any chance, and you may not be at liberty to talk about it, is there any chance we're going to see you on the 24 Paris Olympics as a broadcaster?
You won't see me, but you'll hear me.
Okay. Is that done deal?
Yep. Yep. I will be commentating BMX racing and BMX freestyle.
Fantastic, man. I threw that out there. Not sure if that was even a possibility. I know you've been in front of the TV, but we also know there's a lot of politics that goes involved with getting in front of that TV. And I know
an Olympic gold medal.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, and then again, the fruits of your labor pays off in multiple different ways.
Yeah.
I always like to end our show with some five rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
Yep.
What was the last song that you listened to? I know that you used to use music as a pre-race resource. What's the last thing you listened to on your phone?
Well, today?
Yeah.
I went for a mountain bike ride earlier, so I was listening to some metal. I don't remember the exact song, but might have been something from Bring Me the Horizon or As I Lay Dying or something like that.
Are you somebody that likes to keep up with like the latest and greatest music?
Yeah, for the most part. I also, okay. You know, my favorite is still from the 90s, so.
That's all right. I get mocked because I'm still stuck in the 80s. I still have every 80 album I had in high school was sitting on my phone, and I don't have much else. If I gave you $100,000, what company would you start?
Do I have to start a company or can I just invest it?
Great question. If you invested it, what would you invest it in?
I'm really safe with my stuff. I'm not risky. I'd probably put some in stocks, bonds, and right now you can get 5% of savings account. So I'll take guaranteed 5%.
Amen to that one.
But I've always had this dream. So as I traveled around the world, I loved going to different coffee shops and cool like cafes and just kind of hanging out and meeting locals.
Yeah.
So maybe I would do something like that.
Very cool. When you look at if I gave you two wishes, what would they be?
More wishes?
That's a good one.
I don't know. I'd have to sit and think about it, right? Like, obviously, don't want to do it on a big scale. Do I want to solve world hunger or world peace? Or do I want to be selfish and, you know, pay my parents' house off? You know, it's all sorts of different things you can go with that.
Absolutely. What's your favorite dessert?
I got such a sweet tooth. I always said I was a fat guy in an athlete's body. I don't know if it's council's dessert, but I love donuts. Like donuts, right? And fresh, straight, you know, hot and ready donuts is probably my favorite.
Would you go with like, did you say glazed? That's your go-to?
Usually, no. I like the more fun, exciting stuff, you know, the specialties.
Okay. So you're like a sprinkles kind of guy.
Oh, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it.
Okay. See, I'm a huge donut fan, so I'm pretty blasé. I'm kind of a chocolate glaze kind of guy, or maybe a Boston cream. So we're kindred spirits on the donut thing for sure. Yeah, the last question I have for you, and this is not a loaded question, I promise, because I know who's the most famous person in your phone. And you're not being arrogant. Who is the most famous person in your phone?
I was just thinking about.
And again, it's in your terms. I mean, you could have a president. If it doesn't matter to you, that's not what's relevant.
Right. That's what's making it hard. Like, I've got a bunch of people in the moto industry, like a bunch of factory 450 riders. Like, that's easy.
Yep.
All the way up to, like, my dad's, the guy who owns the company my dad worked at, invented video poker.
Nice.
He's a billionaire.
Yeah.
He's not famous, but, like, he's a big deal.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of Golden Knights, Vegas Golden Knights players, NHL players.
Okay.
I don't know who would be. Rob Beats.
And I promise you, that wasn't a loaded question. The other side of that is, if you could have anybody in your phone, who would you like it to be that you don't currently have in there?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'd have to really think about that, but it'd be somebody who I could learn from, because I'm more to learn. Somebody that I could lean on as a mentor to learn from. I think it would be cool.
That's awesome. Well, man, like I said to you, I cannot thank you enough on behalf of all of our subscribers and listeners. You guys can go on YouTube and you can learn more about Connor and all of his accolades, but I really wanted to spend some time getting into how did this guy get to where he's at? How does he bounce back from so much adversity? Connor, if you wanted people to follow you, I know in the social media, some people are Instagram, X, where would you like people to follow you? Where would you suggest?
All mine are the same, at CotterFields11.
Okay. And everybody, thank you so much for supporting the show. The growth numbers continue to go up. Obviously, it's a new format, but the Coach Rob podcast is going to continue to expand. Like I said, I've got a plethora of guests that we're looking forward to bringing in, having them bring in different subjects. I have asked Connor to come back in the future. One of the things I want to talk to him about is him transitioning out of the athletic professional career as an athlete, and then going into, as you can see, broadcast, public speaking, a lot of corporate engagements. That's another dynamic I'd like to pick his brain on. So when I could get him off of his private Learjet and his caviar, we'll see if we can get him on another show. But for those of you that follow us, for those of you that follow us on Navigating Amateur Motocross, there's a side to Connor that most people are not aware of and his involvement in our sport. And again, if I can find time in his schedule, we will definitely have him on as a guest. So you'll see him there. Connor, on behalf of everybody here, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, and we'll chat with you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.